folks. Hope you had a good day so far. Great to have you with us. I'm Henrik. No C in there, by the way. I don't know what you might have read on the SPLC's website. Well, this is Red Eyes Radio. We come to you three times a week, and we cover some of the most important questions that interests us the most, deemed unacceptable, politically incorrect, hate speech, and simply too controversial to many, but we believe they are too important to ignore. RedEyesCreations.com and RedEyesRadio.net is the website's new alt-right media for new times heading in the right direction. You know, we talk about the importance of art a lot on the show, and we have joining us one of the most interesting and perhaps most influential alternative truth artists, if you want to call it that. He's involved in digital art. David Deese has done a lot to break open a lot of subjects to people, from conspiracy to revisionist history to simply showing us the toxic sludge that we find ourselves in 2015, from GMOs and Wi-Fi smart meters to the, of course, ubiquitous media sludge out there, propaganda, lies, and so much more. If an image speaks a thousand words, as I say, some of these multi-layered and sometimes humorous images as well are like 100 pictures in one. Well, today we're going to talk about his path towards becoming the artist he is today, and get into many of the subjects and topics that he finds to be the most important. But, you know, Mr. Deese cast a wide net and is interested in a lot of different subjects, some that might appeal and others might scare you away. Well, stay tuned, a lot more coming up. Mr. Deese, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. It's good finally speaking with you. Hope you're doing well today.
Well, Henrik, I've been a fan for many years and listened to a lot of your interviews, and I'm thrilled to be on this show with you today. And what would you like to talk about?
Well, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, obviously, you're a fantastic graphic artist. You've become really the go-to guy, you know, in the alternative arena for images, for memes, just overall graphics design, and it's some of the most well-packed and detailed art out there as well in this area. So, I mean, I've known about you, as I said offline to you, for many years, and I wanted to invite you for some time now. It's great to finally have you with us here. And one of the things I really like as well with you is that you're really savvy to some of the areas that some other people kind of avoid, both the immigration question, the JQ, a number of other politically incorrect subjects as well. And I really like that, because some alternative circles, there's a lot of people who, unfortunately, don't support those who manage to question the unquestionable, and they kind of fall into the trap of throwing mainstream labels on folks doing that. So that's something I want to talk a bit more about later. But let's just kind of start at the beginning for those who might not be familiar. I think everyone listening is probably familiar with your work, David, you know. But just tell us, when you woke up to some of the things you did, I mean, you have a background as a professional artist in the entertainment industry. And if I remember your bio correctly, around 2003, you basically woke up to all this stuff. Tell us more. What happened?
2003, I was living in Sweden. I just moved back to America in 2012. I was going through a website called Find the Boeing. That was my awakening. I'd heard something about 9/11, you know, and you know, being an inside job, I didn't know what all that meant. I wasn't really into it. But then when I saw photographs of the Pentagon with this little hole in the side and no wreckage, you know, you've seen it, and it visually, you know, the visual impact of seeing something that completely was opposite to what was being played on the TV for us, that I'd been taught, you know, from watching the news stories. It was not only shocking, but it was like a lot of people, it woke me up, and as they say, and just like when you open your eyes in the morning, that's how I said. So I started diving through all the photographs, pulling as many as I could, and then that was the rabbit trail. I mean, the rabbit hole you go down into, and the more you start to study, the more it opens up. And boy, you know. And at the time, I was I had a friend that I'd met at a at the gym. I was working, you know, I do a little workout there, and he was American, living in Sweden. He had a Swedish wife. He was turns out that he was selling the memberships at the gym. And we were sitting there talking about all this, and then I printed out the photographs and laid them in front of him, because it turned out that he was not only military, but he was CIA. He did show me a CIA card, and he looked at the photographs and said, he pushed them back, and he says, "What are you trying to say?" And I said, what did the photograph say? He says, I know where you're going with this, and I'm not going there because I'm these people, and I trust these people. So he wasn't even willing to consider what I was suggesting. And that was the beginning of me headbutting against people who are not willing to look at information.
Right.
And I know you go through this. We all go through this. We got this, particularly family members, when you wake up and you start to tell everybody around you. And they, you know, it's to the point of not even talking to family at this point. So,
yeah.
You know, you can only imagine that they what they think of me. They really think that I'm anti-American. My own family does. So, hey, it's okay if that's what you think.
You know, I suspect we have a lot in common, too, when it comes to your experiences in Sweden. How did you come to move there? How did you end up in Sweden?
You know, I never had much luck and love in America. I was living in Hollywood, and I found the people. I was made it into Beverly Hills and into these, you know, rich parties. And I, you know, after 20 years there, I was rubbing shoulders with some what I thought was some of the most talented artists, musicians, and hanging out with them. And I still wasn't finding love. And I said, you know what? I gotta look around this planet. And it was about that time that I'd learned about this whole Planet X scenario. I don't know if you know about this, but, you know, when I heard about it and I started to study it, that hit me pretty hard. And I said, you know what? I think there are going to be earth changes, and I don't want to live on the coast here. And then when I looked at moving into farther, where do I move? I looked at Wyoming and Colorado, and I went over there and said, this is not for me. And then the idea of moving to Europe was really appealing because I thought, you know, if I move to Wyoming or Colorado and this doesn't happen, then I'm going to feel really miserable. What am I going to do? Going to move back, you know? So it was a stroke of genius, I thought. If I move to Sweden and it doesn't happen, then I'm in Sweden.
Right.
And so I actually picked a town off the map that was sitting in the heart of Sweden, you know, away from the coast, you know, high in the sea level, and Jönköping, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I lived in Jönköping for 9 years, and then
wow, 9 years.
Sweden actually threw me out. They said, you know, you're up to become a permanent resident here, and we see you don't make enough money to live here. And plus, I was causing a real racket because, you know, with the political art was gaining a lot of wide audience, and then I was writing and telling everybody I was living in Sweden, and this is a lot of attention that Sweden did not want.
Mm-hmm.
I was already being harassed by the secret police there. And followed and all kind of, it was really scary stuff. So
really?
Yeah.
Huh.
They were opening my door. They were unlocking my bike. They were unlocking my door. They were coming in and, you know, they even threw food at a painting that I had in the kitchen and they poured water into my rice machine. It was serious. They were setting me up for, you know, if I didn't cool it.
Did they openly ever approach you and wanted to speak with you on, like?
No. I wrote up all the things that were happening, and there was a fellow in Norway that wrote to me, and he said, "I need your phone number. I need to talk to you about this because I know what's happening to you because the same thing is happening to me." He said, "I have a site where I'm exposing, you know, all the lies of the gas chambers and the Holocaust," and he says, "I'm using some of the art that you designed about that." And he said, that's exactly what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you do not talk about this. The Zionists have taken over the governments, you know, for years. And this is you do not talk about this. You go to prison. Ernst Zundel, you know, a German that was living in America, was grabbed up, taken to Canada, and then to Germany, and was put in prison for 7 years for simply printing a book about the Holocaust.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, it is bad in Sweden, but it's not... It's not that, it's not Germany yet, but it's very, very close. We had Don Park, of course. He does a little bit of different art. It's more kind of really kind of targeting the politically incorrect kind of subjects and some of the racial issues and whatnot. But obviously, from his experience, we know that the cops went and they busted down his door and they hauled him out of his apartment and dragged him off to jail. So it does happen in Sweden as well. But I think you can still talk a little bit about some of these subjects. But I guess if you get out there enough, if you get popular and spread the message, then, you know, watch out.
I was on the list. There's no doubt that this is exactly what was happening. And the feeling that I had from that, particularly when, you know, my buddy calls me and says, let's ride our bikes into town and go get a drink. You know, we go in, come out, you know, and I had one of those big U-shaped locks on my bike, you know, and my bike was gone. I thought I looked, it was moved over about 10 feet and the big lock was sitting in the basket. So, you know, when you get that feeling that you realize they're watching you, following you and creating this, it's just the most rotten, scary feeling.
Yeah.
And I had a good friend in Norway that said, come on, move to Norway. You know, we love you here. You know, I'll arrange it. You know, you can just drive over. And then I just said, you know, I got to get back to America. This is all getting too crazy. It's pretty scary. It's scary stuff.
Well, yeah, we'll talk more about when you move to America later. But it's funny, first of all, how they can let in every imaginable, you know, welfare troll these days into Sweden. But they pick on you for not making enough money. Isn't that incredible?
I don't believe it was about money at all.
Right.
In fact, they said, we'll give you a lawyer so you can contest this. And so I took the free lawyer and ended up staying an extra year because it went through so many different courts. And, the dollar at that time was only worth about 62 cents. And all my money was coming from America. So I had to literally almost make twice as much money to try to prove to them how much money I made, I made plenty of money to stay in Sweden. It was ridiculous, but you know,
it's just because you're white. Let's face it, right? And because you're doing what you're doing.
It's true. In 2003, when I moved there, it was lily white. It was so many blondes everywhere, you know, and it was such a beautiful. Everybody's very thin, also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm highly allergic to MSG. I tell people this story. You know, you see all these huge obese people walking around America, and when I got there. There's a lot of Swedes, they said, you know, why is Americans so fat? And I said, I'll tell you exactly why, because MSG, the chemicals they put in the food makes it addictive, and plus it, you know, destroys your system. The endocrine system sets it up the body retains fat that way. And so they just kind of rolled their eyes and didn't understand it. I kept getting that question. Well, so because I'm allergic to MSG, you know, I looked in the stores and was thrilled that there was no MSG in Sweden in 2003. And I was eating everything, you know, I was eating processed food that I hadn't eaten in years. And so about a year later in 2004, it hit me, you know, this feeling of the sickness feeling. And I looked on the package and there it was. And it literally came in all at once. Every package in the stores now had MSG. And within 6 months, I saw obese people getting on the bus in Sweden. And by the time I left, I was walking behind, you know, it looked like an American, but I knew it was Swede because I could hear him. And it was a thin adult walking, it looked like with their child. And the kid had to been 200 pounds, you know, and it was awful.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, everybody was putting on weight. And I think it really, MSG is weaponized chemical assault because, well, I mean, this, the agenda, it fits into the agenda perfectly with pushing people apart. You know, I mean, no one's attractive when they're fat like that. I mean, look at Americans. It's horrible. It's really horrible. It's almost like another race of giants, you know, beach balls that are walking
around. Thanks to food science, we can now have a Mars bar change your DNA. You know, it's like, yay, great. I mean, it is pretty bad in Sweden these days. And I think around 2003... 2002. That's actually when I started to really kind of avoid, like, get off a lot of those kinds of foods as well, processed. So that when I did begin looking at the labels around that period, I definitely noticed that as well. And it's a huge problem. And I just now when you walk around, you're absolutely right. There's more fat people now in Sweden than there was 10 years ago. It's horrendous.
Oh. It's exactly what it is. And I read enough Swedish. I saw a headline and a story in a newspaper there. And it was talking about, it had said nothing about MSG. All it said was that people are just playing too many video games and not getting exercise. So the Zionist media completely did not want you to know why you're fat and why you're slovenly. And I think the theory on it has got to be that fat people just don't protest. You know, they just don't want to get up.
Right.
And you don't see them walking around with signs or yelling much, you know.
No.
Take a look at some of the protests. There's not a lot of fat people.
Good point. So, yeah, so, I mean, obviously getting harassed is never a fun thing, and it can kind of drive you a little bit crazy to try to figure out who's doing that, what's the reason, and all those kinds of things. But what happened at the end of it? How did you get kicked out? Did you just decide to leave one day? What happened there?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I saved it, but I actually got a letter in the mail that said I had to leave the country.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not so often you get a letter like that.
Now, not these days when the borders are wide open, for Christ's sake. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Because there were so many Arabs that were they were coming in, and I had a friend that was Assyrian. People don't really hear that word Assyria very much, but apparently Assyria was a country that was in the place where they call Iraq now. Iraq wasn't always called Iraq. It used to be called Assyria, and whoever the Iraqis are, they went in and they drove out the Assyrians, and they became the refugees, And now Assyrians, it's a whole subgroup, they look like Iraqis to me. But anyway, I had a friend there that he said, you know, when I moved to Jönköping in 1999, he says, there were 60 of us and we all knew each other because we found each other and we kind of stick together to kind of keep our culture. He says, now there's 6,000.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So, and that was in 10 years. So, and so they brought in 6,000 to a town that's only 80,000.
It's so insane.
Escalating so fast. And then all the blonde girls started dyeing their hair black because they didn't want to stand out. See, there were so many dark haired people coming in that the whole thing about Swedes is they don't want to stand out. If you know this from they teach this in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about, never think that you're better than anybody else, you know, that philosophy that they teach.
Jean Delors, yeah.
Yeah, and it's so destructive. I mean, Americans are the opposite. Americans, you know, they're taught to be competitive and highly egotistical, to think that they're the best, right? Well, Swedes, the way that they control everybody over there, and it's kind of interesting from a mind control viewpoint. So they don't have so many cops. You don't see cops running around everywhere in Sweden. It's because Swedes patrol themselves.
Yeah.
And the way it's done is a very basic philosophy. It starts very early in first grade. They teach them to never think you're better than anybody else and never act like you're better than anybody else. And if you do, then you'll draw attention to yourself. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. And if you do, you'll be criticized. And that's the worst thing possible. Swedes and their nightmares, they don't want anybody to criticize them. They're real sensitive that way. And so what they do is they keep their head down. They don't do anything that would draw attention to themselves. Am I right?
Of course, absolutely. I mean, that's how they managed to push this whole refugee and immigration crisis to this insane level now, because no one wants to speak out. No one wants to be a racist, right? No one wants to preserve
right.
their own culture. And I mean, sure, if you have a homogenous society, I think that mentality as a virtue, it does have some upsides to it. It's just not all bad. But now, basically, as a population control mechanism of having them go along with whatever the government is pushing on them, it's absolutely horrendous. And it's something we have to break out of to be able to, protest and speak up against what's happening to the Swedish people right now.
It's true. You know, psychologically, it has such an effect on a child because, you know, To do anything, you have, particularly in entertainment or in sports, you have to present yourself. You have to actually have an audience, and most Swedes do not want an audience. They're afraid to get up in front of everybody, you really have to have a confidence in yourself to get on a stage and sing and do these things. So I didn't see a lot of creativity in Sweden. I was shocked, after living in Hollywood for so many years, it seemed like everybody played music or, you know, they had their own creativity that they dove into as an escape, I guess. But boy, you know, when I went into the most Swedish houses, they did not have that going on. There's some incredible musicians certainly that are Swedes and artists, but I didn't see much of it in the general population.
Yeah, it's a little bit less. We're more of an industrious, we have that kind of Protestant work ethic, you know, to a certain extent. So it's a little bit different. But see, that's what I like, though, also on top of it, that we have these, you know, various kind of nuances between us of European people. I guess it's more of a Germanic trait of being more you know, industrious and work really hard and get stuff done. And perhaps to some other people on the outside, it seems a little bit more, you know, maybe cold or shut off or whatnot. But, you know, hey, we have the weekends, right? We have the alcoholic, the booze.
We do. And I it's a bad habit that I picked up real fast, you know, because.
Oh, really?
It's because everybody at 5 o'clock on Friday, they went to what they call the after work. And even if you didn't drink, you know, everybody seemed to be there. It was a huge social event. Everybody yep. wanted to be together and talk. And me, I love it. I was in the middle of it. I'd find the place that had the most people because they all wanted to practice their English, and I end up never learning Swedish because everybody wanted me to speak English.
Isn't that strange? Yeah.
And they said, you know, your English is so good because you pronounce everything properly. You know, the English you get in Europe can be really bastardized. It's all kind of, you know, everybody's different version of English.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking it in a way that's very easy to understand. So, but yep. yeah, you go in, you know, Fridays after work, you know, and you drink a lot of wine and do a lot, just talk to everybody, just talk and talk and talk. So I end up meeting everybody, and I end up meeting, this is funny. There was a girl I met from the newspaper, and she says, "You're very interesting. Let's do a story about you." I said, "All right." So she sent two reporters to my house, and they sat down and talked to me for 2 hours. And the first thing they said was, "Why did you come to Sweden?"
Right.
And I start telling them this story about Planet X, you know, and that there's going to be... that there's going to be this Earth changes. I said, "This is a safe area," and I said... And the great thing about you Swedes is that the government really, you know, will help you, where the American government will simply go underground and let everybody fend for themselves. And then I told them about, you know, all the art I did, and I worked with, you know, I worked in Hollywood. They were fascinated that anybody, you know, would ever move from Los Angeles to, you know, Jönköping. I mean, it was such a bizarre, I was in the bizarro world, you know.
Right.
To me, it was great. I mean, it was so exotic. I was the exotic in their eyes, but I mean, the place I was in was pure Scandinavia, the heart of Scandinavia.
Yep.
And I was fascinated with everything. I mean, everything was different visually and textures and sights and sounds. And so for me, I was really having a good time. And at the end of this interview, they said, you know, I told them about aliens and, you know, I told them all this wild paranormal stuff, and they said, "Wait a minute, you don't want us to really print this, do you?" And I said, "Yeah." I was surprised because they were just listening, you know, writing, but they were listening. And then they said, "No, you don't want to print this. This will everybody's going to read this." And I go, "Yeah, that's the idea." No, you don't understand this society. And I said, "I tell you what. Everything I said, I want you to print." So they did, and when the paper hit the street, you know, everybody read it and passed it around because it was so bizarre. This bizarre guy with red hair was walking around, you know, from America, and then when I would walk in, you know, on Fridays, when I walked in a place, I could see half of the people come towards me and the other half run. It was it really. And people came up and introduced themselves, and for years I was the guy that came to Sweden for UFOs. They didn't know quite the story. They just knew that I was here to be picked up by UFOs. So,
awesome.
I talked to a girl, and her friend would come up and whisper in her ear, and then they would both walk away very frightened, you know. So.
Jeez, yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, it's conformity, I would say, but they're always, I think, in a sad kind of way, but I guess it's good. But, you know, we'd be more willing to listen to an American, or especially from Hollywood, right? As you said, it's like, ooh, fascinating, right? So, but
well, their idea of America was just Hollywood, you know,
what
they see in the movies. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, which is understandable, but still. You know, they got no clue. They were talking about, I'm from such a great place. I go, oh, it's not. It's a dark place. It's all a facade.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. You know, I think there's value to that, and I'm sad to see things transforming so fast. Do you still think, I don't know when you left, but do you still think Sweden is a safe place? Will it be a safe place in the future?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
you think
absolutely.
So? Really?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was introduced to a guy, an old man, who, when he found out my story, he wanted to talk to me. And he says, you know, I worked, he was some sort of a builder. And he says, I worked on an underground base. And he said, I don't know where it is because they put us on a bus and took us there into the forest, you know. And if you know Sweden, holy smokes, talk about trees. I mean, I don't know. If anybody got lost in those trees, you would never find your way out because it's mostly just trees, you know. And he says, you go into the forest and he drove into the underground base and holy smokes, it's giant. There's a whole city under the ground. And he said, it's all stocked. For the whole population, which at that time was only 9 million. I don't know what it is now, but, you know, they have underground, bases there that are all ready to go. If anything goes wrong, they can put their whole country underground.
When was this?
Completely.
Again?
This was 2003.
Yeah, I think they've done away with a lot of that, to be honest, because a lot of the resources I know recently, unless, of course, it's a official versus unofficial kind of issue here we're talking about, but, I know that they had a lot of food and a lot of preparation. They had these skyddsrum, they call it, which is like protection rooms, basically, where, you know, population can go. But in the last, they've started to phase this out, I know. So that now,
oh,
this,
come
the,
on.
Yep, the situation is completely different now. Yep.
No. He said the ceilings were so high, it was massive. He said it's the size of a city. It's not anything. It's not a room. It's not a room with some food in it. We're talking about everything you need. He said he even saw the area for the royals, which was so, he said it wasn't even that elaborate, but it was very big, you know, long corridors, you know, miles of underground roads and streets and stuff. It's just a whole city. And imagine what America's got. You know, they worked, they spent these trillions of dollars, or billions anyway, for this underground base under the Denver airport. They say that's the real mecca, but mm-hmm. It's connected with underground systems that, you know, there's been interviews with these truck drivers that say they went underground and drove for, you know, 500 miles. So there's tunneling, the underground bases are everywhere. It's just, the whole America is riddled with them.
Right.
But they won't let any civilians under there. But they got it all planned out for all the, you know, these stupid politicians and these.
Well, exactly. This is it. I think it's for elite. I think it's the same in Sweden. I did a tour of some of the ex-military underground facilities on the West Coast. We drove around for, well, practically a whole day. There was a guy there. Some of them had been rented out for like server spaces and stuff, but a lot of them were surprisingly empty. You could literally see like the coffee cups from the 80s were just like still there. You know, it was like they didn't use it or fixed it up in any way. You know,
it was an underground base you went to.
Well, it's, you know, military. Well, yeah, it is a base, but it's like, yeah, ready center for the military, and it was in various mountain locations. This was on the west coast of Sweden, so Bohuslän and Västra Götaland. And, a lot of them were just inactive, but you could still actually go in. This guy had a key, so it was quite fascinating to see. I didn't see anything what you described, not in that type of space, if you will, but, you know, smaller ones compared to that.
Yeah. Well, type in deep underground military bases. No, what is it?
Yeah.
Dumb is the... Yeah. Yeah, dumbs. Okay, is that right? Does that spell out?
Yeah.
But anyway,
yes.
Yeah, but they have machines that cut through solid rock, you know, that are 20 feet tall, that they can go through miles a day. So you can imagine what they've got. So anyway, but the thing about Earth Changes is that, because I was a big fan, or still am, a fan of ZetaTalk.com. It's Z-E-T-A Talk. And the premise is that this lady, Nancy Leader, was contacted in 1995 by these good gray aliens, not the mean ones, you know, and that only wanted to help people through these coming Earth changes, which I'm apparently a part of helping other people through it, because I'll tell you more about that later. But I lost my train of thought.
Oh, sorry, no problem. Well, I got to say, I followed, you know, some of that for a few years, and God, they've done a lot of failed predictions over the years as well, haven't they? ZetaTalk, and it was just, you know, 2003 was going to happen, then of course it was going to happen in 2012. It's like, because when I asked you, whether you think Sweden is safe. I didn't mean necessarily from a Planet X point of view or Earth changes. Some of that is going to turn into a dud, in my view, actually. But I was thinking about the social fabric of the kind of conditions that they're creating for themselves now with all this mass immigration and stuff like that. That it's like there's a lot of conflict and chaos. And look at the riots in the suburbs and all this kind of stuff that they've created for themselves now, you know?
Well, Zionists have taken over all the governments in Europe, and they've all signed on to the EU. We know that the agenda, if you look at the protocols of Zion, you really got to go back. If you really want to understand this subject, you got to do what I've done, and that's go back and study history, starting with the Communist Manifesto in 1849 or whatever it is, then up, to the first Zionist Congress, then study World War One, how it was created. Be sure and watch The Greatest Story Never Told.
Oh, yeah.
To understand who Hitler was and why World War II was created by the Zionists to destroy Europe. I mean, to destroy Germany, right?
Yep.
Then you get an idea of how willing they are to with their agenda. And Europe is just, they want a new world order. They want a one world government, and that's part of it. The people that are being flooded in as refugees, they don't go and help the refugees. They just want to flood them in to destroy these cultures, because that's how you take over. It's a weapon. These people are weapons that they're being inflicted on Sweden and the France, Sharia law, all the Islam, you mix cultures. They're not there to become French. They're there just to,
That's right.
Disrupt everything, destroy everything. And
you did, by the way, I gotta say, you did a really good piece on that one of your Sheeple covers. You did the injection of multiculturalism into the Nordic countries, and of course with Barbara Spector's quote in it, and really well made.
With the hypodermic needle that had Muslims in it.
That's right.
It was actually being injected into Sweden, because I saw them do it.
Of course,
they were coming off the train.
It's even worse now. You have no idea what's happening right now. I mean, it's 10. I mean, in 2010, the floodgates literally opened. But what we have now, what has happened since this summer, I mean, it's they're building tent cities now. It's insanity. They're utterly insane. This is not going to end well. It's just going to be utter chaos.
The great thing was that the Jews in Malmo are having to leave because all the Muslims coming in yelling at them.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah. It's so ironic, because the Jews that are leaving have no clue that it was Jews that put them there to begin with, that put the, brought in all the Arabs.
That's right. Organized intellectual Jewish community, the Zionists that are, of course, pushing for this kind of stuff. But I think they're willing to take that because, frankly, they want to have as many Jews back to Israel as they can. Look at Netanyahu when these so-called terrorist actions happen in France and Copenhagen. The first thing they lobbied for was to have all Jews go back to Israel, right?
Right, but, I mean, there's a subject. people realize, more and more that the Jews in Israel, the ones that are all migrated there, they're not Jews at all. They're Khazars. They're from Khazaria, which is just the northern part of Ukraine. So when it hit the internet and a lot of people realize that they've been scammed, that these aren't really Jews, think about it. You got a lot of white people, a lot of Jews, they look like white people. They're not Jews. They're all really just white people, okay? That's the sick, ironic part of all this, is that here is a group of white people, they call themselves Jews, that are destroying the white race. The whole thing about immigration is that they're flooding in all these people into Europe is to destroy the white race, destroy the white cultures. That is the biggest competition that international Jewry has. The Germans really stood up to them, they're really good at it.
They never want to have that happen ever again. I think they got so scared with the rights of national socialism that they realized that if we are to succeed with our master plan of a globalist government and all this kind of stuff, we have to take out the competition basically. And this is but don't you think they're pushing too fast and too hard? Because I mean, there are a lot of Europeans that are waking up to this now, and they're becoming savvy to a subject, which they never would be aware of otherwise.
It's too late. Once you flood in, you know, when you have a white race that dominates a country and you flood them in, they become the minority. It's over, because the Arabs that are coming in are having children at three times the rate that the whites are. You know, so look at the math of it. It's going to take a few years where the whites are going to be the minority, and now it's really frightening, you know, because I don't have children. I don't know if you have children. But whites aren't big on having children.
I wonder why. Look at the media and the way they portray that whole thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, but, you know, you see the Arab family, they're carrying along. Oh, and then I know Jewish families that have six children, you know, because they want to have as many as possible. Because
yeah.
they want, anyway.
Yeah. No, I
don't get
you.
Me started. I mean,
it's a good topic. It's a really important yeah. one. You know, we've talked about this on the show for a few times now because it's, I mean, it's I think everything else kind of stands and falls according to this. All the issues of trying to combat the globalist powers that we're talking about, that's not going to be doable if the Europeans go. In my opinion, we have a technical know-how, we have organizational yeah. skill in a way that, for whatever reason, some others don't, and I think that they've targeted us as a threat for that reason. So. My point is, we're not a minority yet in our countries, and look at the kind of nationalism that's on the rise in Europe right now. I don't think it's over, not yet.
It's not over, and plus, the only thing that's going to save the white race at this point, and this is shocking to say, is that I think that Russia is realized what Zionism is doing. I know they have. And that's why they're encouraging having children, and also blocking. You know, you don't see them flooding in so many Arabs and certainly not Asians into Russia, do you?
No, not too much. No.
Yeah. So they're you know, you don't see Japan flooding in people. Or you don't see you know, these other. It's only white countries
that's
that
right.
are flooding in either. And America, you know, it's coming from South America. You know, I lived in L.A. and watched it over 20 years, you know, from I was there in the 80s, early 80s.
Oh, boy.
And then by the time I left, you know, it was little Mexico. It was horrible.
Absolutely. Reconquista. They're taking over through the birth canal, as they say. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did one piece. It was a piece of art about anchor babies. And I had this baby being born out of the, you know, coming out of the hospital like a giant monster, and it was a movie poster called Invasion of the Anchor Babies.
And I remember that one. That was excellent.
Oh, do you?
Tell us a bit about, I mean, there's so many other, you know, subjects here that we can talk about. We should. We'll get into some of these later. But just tell us a bit about your art. So some of the, you know, the motivation behind it. What do you think it you know, it does to people? It's very powerful. There's a lot of messages that are incorporated into your to the themes that you touch upon, and it's just such an efficient way of doing it. Instead of, like, you know, writing an entire book about the subject, you can literally yeah. look at one of these pictures and, like, get it immediately, you know.
Well, that's the way it's designed. I'll tell you, give you a little background of how I do it. I started off back in the 80s. I was when I got out, became a commercial artist. You know, I had two ways to go. I could either be a fine artist and do paintings of, you know, landscapes, or, you know, when I sent off for the book from the college, there was a photograph of a guy sitting at a drawing table. He was drawing a cheeseburger with some magic markers. And when I saw that, I knew I was in heaven, because that, for some reason, I said, that's what I want to do. So the next thing I know, I'm sitting in an art studio, a high-end art studio in Atlanta, Georgia, and all the clients were from, you know, big ad agencies in New York and Chicago. And we were doing, and they were paying me next to nothing, just enough for rent, you know, and barely get by. And I don't know how much they were getting for these, but they were in Time Magazine, they were in every major magazine and newspaper and billboards, you know. Mm-hmm. I was doing high-end, you know, advertising. I did that for 3 years. And, you know, I learned how to design, you know, what you want to do is you want to get the communication, the basic communication across as fast as possible, but in an interesting way that grabs somebody's attention. I mean, you only have a second, and that's all it takes, because, you know, it's not like words. Words you have to study, you know, and they are symbols too. words are just symbols.
Yeah.
But it becomes very complicated, you know. But an image has such an impact, and you know that's why the media is controlled, because they know what the power of the media is. It's a visual communication. You know, all these videos, these movies and stuff, it has control over the minds and everything. So anyway, it's funny that I was in the middle of mainstream media for years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was doing advertising. I was doing the stuff that you would have seen. You know, I wanted to be more in entertainment. So I left that and I went to L.A. And the next thing I know, I had an agent, you know, a Jewish agent, of course. But she was so connected. And my first big client was Paramount. So I was doing Paramount Home Video for many years there. They paid very well.
Do you do, like, animations too then? Or is it just
No. Still? I was, when they would have a video, they would bring me in and... sometimes we've designed the video, or the video had already been designed, the cover, and we just need to create a store display, you know, expand on the concept of the video cover and mm-hmm. illustrate it, you know, and then there would be these big displays, and I was painting all those things, you know, I was doing Friday the 13th Part 6, and I was doing Beverly Hills Cop Part 2, and, you know, I mean, everything that was coming out, I was in the middle of it, you know, I mean, it paid real well.
Right.
I was making six figures for a few years there.
Oh boy, really?
Yeah, yeah. And I was, you know, and I would go to parties, and you know, I kind of was living the, you know, what you think was the dream, in a sense. I mean, as an artist, holy smacks, you know, it was a lot of fun.
It was really your curiosity then of those other subjects that kind of took you in a different route, obviously.
Well, in 1990 or so, or 91, that's when the computers came in. Because I was doing all airbrush. See, this was all paint.
Right.
I was sitting at a drawing table working like a fast order cook, you know, because it was a series of, you know, you had to take acetate, you know, big sheets of 30 by 40 clear, you know, 5 millimeter acetate. And with an X-Acto knife, you had to cut out all the shapes and then airbrush. And it was just so complex and it was tough. It was a tough job, and not many people could do it. I did have an agent one time that called me up, and she says, I just want to tell you that I was in a pretty high-powered meeting. You know, there was some pretty, it was in a movie, one of the studios, and we were discussing, you know, they were discussing, they brought me in, because I have a stable of artists, and I said, you're not with me, but they were discussing who they could get, and your name came up, and I just want to tell you that your name came up when they were trying to figure out who they were going to get. So I took that as a compliment. I was in the middle of all that for a little while.
Mm, yeah.
But emotionally, it, you know, never was satisfying. But, you know, I in the 90s, I got way more into going to UFO conventions, and it was there that it was 92, I believe, that in my hand landed a 25-page Xerox copy of William Cooper, you know, Bill Cooper.
Sure.
He had written out, it was the first writings, his first layout of his book, Behold a Pale Horse. This was a year before that came out. But he had just written out what he knew. And I read this, and he was talking about the secret government, you know, and it was my first exposure to, this is some very serious conspiracy. I mean, this is the height of conspiracy when you got a whole government that's secret, that is in cahoots with an alien race, and that is, you know, that it control, that the whole, it was talking about how the front office of all the politicians and the people that we consider controlling the planet have nothing to do with any of that. So, you know,
yeah.
So this was my first introduction to, this was pre-internet. So this was, I was sort of into William Cooper before he even came out with Behold a Pale Horse. So.
Right. Early on. When did you make the switch over to computer and digital graphics?
Took me a while because I couldn't really seem to mimic. Now I can really mimic the airbrush. I'm much better digital than I ever was with that. But Yeah, I think I bought my first computer in 95 or 96. And it just kind of sat there because I wasn't yet able to do it. And it was about 97 I came up, I did my first real piece and said, oh, you know what? This is the way to go.
So, much easier.
But I never, the political art, being political was not anywhere on my mind. It wasn't until, 2003 I woke up to 9/11 and I was looking at the Jeff Renz site because he used to have that, he still does. He had the splash. He describes it as the cover of a magazine. When you go, the first thing you see is a big visual.
Yep.
And so I saw occasionally there was kind of artist stuff, and I thought, you know what? Someday I want to do a piece and send it to him and see if he posts it. And I did. He posted it within minutes, and immediately I got an audience, and I said, this is fun, and I just. He posted it for a few days, and then I did another one, and then I ended up, I was with him for 9 years. I'm not with Renz anymore.
Right.
But I did over around 600 pieces and got a really wide audience.
Yeah, I mean, you're all over the place in the alt movement and everything else, and as I said, you're really the go-to artist with this kind of stuff. And, of course, you do book covers, and you do, I think you released a calendar and stuff like that too, didn't you?
I did a calendar. It didn't really sell too well. I don't think it got advertised very much, but the political art, they don't pay anything. I mean, just because I illustrate chemtrails, in an interesting way, it doesn't pay anything.
No.
And the only reason you don't see other artists, that are certainly better, more talented than me. It's not that I'm so talented. It's just that no one else is doing it because you don't get paid to do it.
Yep.
And for some reason, I'm just driven. I just went nuts and could hardly even do the paying jobs because I was so fixated on trying to illustrate all the corruption I was seeing. What happened was is that when I started doing that, I at that time I was doing Sesame Street magazine. I for 15 years I illustrated Sesame Street magazine, and that was my biggest client at that point. So I was drawing a lot of Elmos and Big Birds and stuff. And here on the other hand, I was I was illustrating the sickest, most violent control of the planet.
Yeah,
And then they were Zionists. My best friend there. Get this, my best friend was the editor of Sesame Street magazine. I'd never met her, but she was in New York. She was super, super Zionist Jew. And at that point, I didn't even know about Zionism,
Yeah.
I mean, I could care less about Jews, and most people feel that way. I didn't know what the fuss was. I just knew that there's people hated Jews, and I used to say to her, all the Jews I met were really smart, and they were funny, and they were successful, and that's my only experience with Jews. It never mean to me. And I said to her, why is the problem? What's the problem? And she says, I don't know. Well, when I found about 9/11 and I started telling her about it, she was irate. I mean, she wasn't having it.
Of course.
She was not having any of it. I mean, it was Arab hijackers. And so our relationship just got crumbled, and I couldn't talk to her anymore.
Funny how that works out, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, some critique. Well, you'd think these some of these topics, in a way, would be some good news to them, at least in terms of the alleged mass murder and everything, that there wasn't that many people killed that they claim it was. That would be some good news,
Right? I mean, if somebody came to me and said, all these people you thought died didn't, wouldn't you be happy?
Exactly.
No.
Of course.
No, they're not happy at all.
Because they need it.
They use the being victims as that's their control. So.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're going to take a break in a little bit here. I do want to talk a little bit more just, of course, about the website so people know where to go and how they can, hire your services, basically, as a way to support you and have you continue going. Because some of the compositions are just, I mean, they're really well made. They're just great. I love the way you manage to take an image of, some generic guy in a suit or something, and then you put Putin's face on there, and it fits perfectly on there. And I know how long it takes because I do videos, so I know how long it takes to be out there looking for good images and just searching and finding the right kind of stuff. So I know how much time it takes, believe me.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I have to – not only is it the correct pose, but it's got to be the lighting and – you know, is nothing's ever right. Some of these pieces, it'll take five different photographs to assemble one person.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And you're trying to try not to make it look too much like Frankenstein walking around. You gotta smooth it all out.
But. Exactly. Well, give us your website and tell us how people can get a hold of you if they want to have book covers made or anything like that.
Yeah, like I was saying, I don't get paid to do the political art, but I do book covers, and I do. I've been doing that for the last 10 years, pretty well. It's a dds.com, dees.com. And you can find, you know, you can contact me through that, and you can see a whole gallery of book covers. Today, I've got the new Sheeple. It's Sheeple number 29, and the images of, well, it's I'll read the headlines. Escalating UN 2030 agenda is the satellite imagery proves that geoengineered drought in California. You know, the satellite images of off the coast of California show that they spray these grids of chemtrails, you know, of geoengineered all the aluminum and barium and stuff, whatever it is they would spray, and in front of these storms. I mean, there's this huge drought, and it's because the storms that come in off the Pacific are not going into California. But it turns out is the storms are still there. What's the difference? Is that the HARP and the chemtrail grids disintegrate these rainstorms that are coming through from the Pacific. Now, why would they do that? Right? You know, when you no rainfall for the last 2 years, and I've been here. I'm in Oregon. You know, I'm in southern mm-hmm. Oregon, right at the California border. And holy smokes, it's just blue sky with a bunch of chemtrails here. You know, and when I moved here, we had a rainy season. Man, it would just flood, and now it's over. It's just bone dry. And all the trees here in autumn, you know, they don't turn to colors like you see. They just turn brown.
Right.
And there's a lot of trees dying. It's a mess. But anyway, the point is that on the cover, it's saying, you know, there was some general or somebody was saying, we'll own the weather by 2025. I think that was the quote. They're owning the weather. They're able to control droughts, you know, and then the East Coast has now had the coldest and wettest on record, you know. Anyway, it's a it's a big mess.
Yeah,
all the lakes in California are now just puddles.
Well, exactly. These droughts are absolutely horrendous. Pretty bad fires this year in California as well, wildfires and everything else. So yeah, there's a lot of consequences here. There's a lot of some of these other issues I'm going to get into in the next segment as well. We're going to take a break here shortly. I just wanted to again plug the website, folks. dees.com. Check it out. Some fantastic work. If you haven't seen it before, I'm sure you have. And there's art on a lot of different topics, of course, on political issues and some of these more metaphysical issues as well. So do take a look. And of course, consider hiring David as well for some of the services to help him out so he can continue to remain a political artist in this way. All right, very good, folks. We'll take a short break right here. We'll be right back with more with David Dees, so stay with us. All right, that's the first hour. You know, we have more coming up here in the second with David Dees. If you're new to the show, we have a member section where we have all previous shows archived, and also the second hour of our shows are available there. First hour is always free, sometimes both, but when you do want to hear the rest, check out our archives for much more. Well, in the member section, you know, David continues detailing some of his artwork, including the Holocaust Exposé series that he has not yet released. We talk about the magical mind control world of Hollywood, and Dees explains the programming effect of his works. You know, Dees says that we are at the cutting edge of expanding consciousness, and the time is ripe for artists of all breeds to aid in the awakening of the programmed reality-avoiding masses, while of course inspiring other creative souls as well. We talk some more about Sweden and compare Sweden's culture to the U.S. We get into Agenda 21, the Wildlands Project, and then later David gives us an idea of what to expect if we enter into some kind of magnetic reversal, basically, something we've talked about many years ago, and of course how to prepare for something like that. But we end talking a bit about the 2016 presidential candidates as well, and get into Trump. So stay tuned. RedEyesMembers.com is the website where you can find out more and sign up for a membership. It's only €5 per month. You can sign up for a three-month subscription, non-recurring or recurring. We also have from 6 months up to 2 years non-recurring available for you as well. Well, ladies and gentlemen, see our upcoming guests in the radio archive for much more. But we'll be right back with our number two.